Welcome to the New Books Network, the African American Studies channel. I'm your host, James Stansel, and today I talk with the author of In the Name of the Mother, Italian Americans, African Americans, and Modernity, from Booker T. Washington to Bruce Springsteen. The author is Dr. Samuele F.S. Pardini. He's an associate professor at Elon University in North Carolina, and his book is published by the Dartmouth College Press. I really enjoyed talking to Sam about his book, and he also, of course, reminded me of my home state of North Carolina. He promised me he was going to get a barbecue sandwich for me or some Bojangles chicken, you know, in return for the interview, so hopefully he'll live up to his promise. But you're really going to enjoy this interview. It was very wide-ranging, and he really goes into a lot of depth and detail explaining the connections between the Italian-American community and the African-American community, going all the way back to southern Italy. So listen up and enjoy this interview about the connections between African-Americans and Italian-Americans. In the Name of the Mother, and the author is Samuele Pardini. Enjoy. Hello, and welcome again to the African-American Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, James Stansel, and it is my great pleasure today to welcome a man who's in my home state of North Carolina. He makes me a little homesick every time I speak with him. But we're here with Samuel F.S. Pardini. He is an associate professor at Elon University in Elon, North Carolina. And we're going to be talking with him about his book, In the Name of the Mother, Italian Americans, African Americans, and Modernity, from Booker T. Washington to Bruce Springsteen. Mr. Pardini, how are you today? Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, James. Thank you for having me the podcast. It was very nice to meet you.
Very nice talking to you. Absolutely. I've enjoyed, you know, we have a lot of conversations on New Books Network before we ever turned the recording on. And I must say, yours is one of my most enjoyable. I really enjoy talking with you and getting to know you and talking about home. You know, I'm out here in Houston now. And, you know,
sorry that I make you a little homesick.
That's okay. Well, one thing you can do for me, Sam, is if you can go to Smithfield's Chicken and Barbecue and eat a barbecue sandwich with coleslaw and hush puppies on my behalf, then everything will be okay. Or Bojangles.
No problem. That's going to be very easy to do for me. I wouldn't mind at all.
Right, absolutely. One of those two things, if you can do one of those two things for me, then, hey, we are okay.
Consider it done.
All right. And so your book is published by Dartmouth College Press. And, you know, we talked a little bit, you know, offline about your history. It's a great American story, Sam. And so if you can maybe share with us a little bit about your background, you know, how you came to writing this book and your interest and so forth with the audience. I think they would love to hear it.
Yes. So I was born and raised in a small town along the coast of Tuscany in Italy. Mm-hmm. And I came to the United States in 1997 because I had a fellowship from the State University of New York at Buffalo to pursue a PhD in comparative literature. Mm-hmm. And I had come to the United States before. I had some family here. My mom's uncle came to this country back in the 30s. One of the last, I guess, immigrants from Southern Eastern Europe to come to the U.S. before World War II and after immigration was essentially, from Europe, was essentially shut down in 1921 and 24 by Congress. So I had come to visit him, but, you know, it was in 97 that I came for good, and I completed my PhD in comparative literature, like I said, at Buffalo, where I studied with the great fortune and blessing, really, to study with Leslie Fiedler, the famous literary critic and historian of American culture. And I actually got very, very close with him, and after he passed away, I was able to do two books of essays in Italy, that I published in Italy of his.
Okay.
One was about all the stuff that he wrote about Italian culture and literature, and another small book about a few essays about war and American culture that he wrote. And then I actually did a book here in the United States for Counterpoint Press in 2008 called The Devil Gets His Due, The Uncollected Essays of Leslie Fiedler.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Which collects pretty much all, not all, but close to all the essays that he didn't collect in a book.
Okay.
You know, from the very first piece that he published in 1943 to the very last one, which he published just a couple of months before he passed away, and covering a span of rather some 50 years of scholarship. Wow. So it's a good book to get your teeth on if you want to get, if you're interested in his work.
And can you repeat Can you repeat the name?
Yeah, it's called The Devil Gets His Due, The Uncollected Essays of Leslie Fiedler, and it's Counterpoint Press, 2008, and paperback 2010.
Okay,
and,
go ahead, sure.
How I got into my book, after doing that, I started teaching, as I said, I have I'm training comparative literature and comparative studies, and my focus is, my main interest is on 20th century modernity and the study of modernity and the relationship between humanistic culture in the West and modernity.
Okay.
And I got interested in Italian-American studies while I was in graduate school, although nobody was offering any class or teaching any class. And so I asked permission, I was granted permission to start teaching Italian-American studies as an undergraduate class, which I did, and ever since, this is like 2000, essentially, after I finished my coursework, ever since 2000, I continue to teach and then research, of course, Italian-American studies. And I was also interested in relating this area of studies to the larger context of American studies, and especially African-American studies. And so little by little, I started, you teach, you do research, you start having an idea of what my view might not be there, and I started putting together material that I thought, material that I didn't teach, but that I was interested in. And I came, to the conclusion that there was a book to be made.
Okay.
And I started the process. I jot down notes. I put down a plan for it, and I was supported by my school very well. They gave me, enough money to pursue research or prize that I needed to be done. And going to conferences, bring over to campus people that've been instrumental then. Read parts of the book, the usual networking that you do when you do this kind of work, I would guess. So then I put down a plan. Originally, the book was mostly centered in Italian American literature and culture, popular culture. But the more I got into it, the more I saw the black presence into this culture.
Right.
And then, I started finding African American relevant African American material, literature, and other stuff that had what I think is a substantial or significant Italian presence in it, and started connecting the dots and say, why is there this exchange? This investment, I think the key word is, why at the beginning of the 20th century, when you have obviously the big immigration from Europe, and especially from the central and southern part of Italy, the United States, which essentially is the biggest transfer of people from one continent to another, probably in history, relative to the time, to the time period. And I say, how come right at the beginning of the, between the end of the 19th century, the early 20th century, when segregation begins officially in the South, you start seeing this African-American investment, cultural, literary, historical, into Italian. And so that's how the book developed, you know. And the methodology was, like I said, I'm training comparative studies. Mm-hmm. I studied with Leslie Fiedler, so I was interested in using different areas of culture.
Okay.
To create what I called, you know, a region of culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would go between, across the Atlantic, and you know, from one place to another, back and forth, and they would delineate a precise, like I say, regional culture, not just in terms of, you know, disciplines, but also in terms of periodization.
Okay.
And theoretically speaking.
Right.
So I was very interested in using symbols and symbolic domains, you know, and see how, you know, they are essentially a mirror of modes of production.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then I needed something to center the book.
Right.
Essentially. Right. And I started realizing that in both cultures that I was dealing with,
mm-hmm.
and even in the overlapping of them between the two, there was this central metaphor of the mother, which is what the title refers to.
In the name of the mother, right.
Yeah, although also there's a little religious reference to that.
Of course.
The prayer, obviously. And, but, you know, this metaphor of the mother, you know, that returns time and again in the material that I'm dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And it became clear to me that that was the central metaphor around which I could organize and tie together the whole thing, which is what happened. And then periodization-wise,
mm-hmm.
and which also, the periodization also dictated the selection of the material. I said, first of all, I want to publish the book before I'm ashes. So I need to set clear boundaries.
Right.
You know, you can't cover everything. Don't get into, you know, when you author your first book, you know, you really want to
you do everything.
As good as
everything
possible.
In there.
You want to throw in everything you can. A good thing to do is, you know, set clear boundaries. Don't overdo it.
That's great advice.
You know, so that's what I said. But the other point was like this investment of African Americans and Italian immigrants and Italian Americans begins right at the beginning of segregation, essentially, or at least the foundation of what is considered African-American literature, I would guess,
mm-hmm.
you know, or one of the founding texts, which is Johnson and the autobiography of an ex-colored man. And it lasts for sure until right around the civil rights movement.
Okay.
With some sort of like consistency. And in every major shift, either literary or historical, you know, the passage from the foundation, if you want, of African-American literature that Johnson began, and then, you know, the Harlem Renaissance, and then the Great Depression, then the 50s and the post-World War II literature, there's a significant author, African-American author, that deals with Italian-Americans or the Italian presence there. So I say, okay, these are the boundaries,
mm-hmm.
more or less,
mm-hmm.
of the book. Because I think that after the civil rights movement and the legislation, I think that you need a different set of conceptual tools to go about it, you know. And
that sounds,
so I said,
that sounds like
this
a sequel
is,
to me.
Well, we'll see about that, you know. I mean, one of the goals of the book is that to promote this kind of research.
Absolutely.
Because one of the advantages and disadvantages at the same time that I had, that there was almost, I mean, next to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There was no such a thing as a full book. There was an article that was very, very important for me.
Okay.
Which is Robert Orsi article.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Orsi is a professor at Northwestern University in Evanston, in Illinois, and is a scholar of U.S. Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this very important book about Italian Americans called Madonna 115th Street.
Okay.
And but he also wrote a very important essay about the religious faith of Italians and how race pretty much not just influence, but like the identity of Italian Americans is racially inflected.
Mm.
And he used the terms to define Italian Americans racially. He calls them the in-between people.
Right, right.
Who are neither black nor white. You know, right. Some sort of like this in-between kind of like identity that is hybrid, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an essay that was very important to me. And I came out with this concept that I use in pretty much a whole book,
mm-hmm.
that is a driving concept called invisible blackness.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
That is a way of defining this in-between status of Italian,
right.
but to take it out of the religious context that Orsi uses and translate it and articulate it to different areas,
such as
culture and popular culture, literary culture, and so forth.
And that really spoke to me too. That whole concept of invisible blackness, because I mean it's true. I mean, you know, we talked a little bit about Mike Tirico offline, the sports journalist, you know, and you know the kind of ambiguity about his race. And you know, and the further connections between you know African Americans and Italian Americans you see in popular culture and movies and such, which you get into a lot here in your text. But that invisible blackness, and some would consider that controversial. They don't, you know, maybe they don't want to be associated with blacks or blackness or vice versa. But I think
absolutely. Yeah,
right.
I mean, this is so true.
It's almost like a mind field.
Oh, it is, not almost. It is a minefield. You know, I mean, I don't think I discover, you know, anything or say anything new or radical
right.
by saying that, you know, as if you're not white, but if you associate with white and whiteness,
right.
you have some privilege in this country,
right?
So
it makes a difference.
And it is essentially, you know, to a large extent, this is the story of immigration, you know, in the 20th century,
indeed.
Of what the so-called white ethnics, that little by little, distance themselves from everything or anything that can be associated with, you know, some sort of blackness or otherness in any case, right?
And
they try to pass and embrace whiteness, you know.
Right. And the whole idea of the involuntary immigrants. And the voluntary, you know, immigrants, and you know exactly what you're talking about there, Sam. When people come in, they're kind of all viewed the same, you know, as being you know, a bit of an outsiders. But the longer that they stay, and you know, in a lot of cases, you know, they can become accepted and distance themselves from some of the other groups. And African Americans, you know, coming in, you know, as involuntary immigrants, that's something that you know many would argue that we can never escape. So even though, you know, you're an immigrant group, let's say, like, you know, many others that have come over time, you know, the Irish and the Italians and so on and so forth, you know, have kind of been able to, you know, escape that kind of otherness. But African-Americans, to a sense, have not, you know, that no Irish need apply. And, you know, and some of
yes.
the, you know, the earlier rules and regulations against Italians and some other Central and Eastern Europeans when they first began immigrating here. And the name of the book, you know, we've been talking for a while, and we're getting some great dialogue here between myself and Sam Pardini. But the book is In the Name of the Mother, Italian Americans, African Americans, and Modernity, from Booker T. Washington to Bruce Springsteen. And I'm here with the author, Samuel F.S. Pardini. He is a scholar. He's an author. And, you know, he's a professor at the Elon University. He's an associate professor at Elon University in North Carolina. And Sam, before we go further, I wanted to make sure I got all your titles correct. So if you could, just tell everyone who and what you do at Elon.
Yeah, I'm an associate professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures.
Right.
I'm also the coordinator of the American Studies Program and I serve my second and last term as a faculty resident of the Honors Program.
The Honors Program.
I teach for the most part. I split between American studies and Italian studies.
Right.
And as of late, I focus more on the, you know, comparative American studies kind of teaching.
Right. I wanted to make sure I got that in so people could know all the things that you do, and you are an outstanding, a great scholar, and you did great work here in the name
Thank
of the
you.
Mother. You're welcome, Sam. And as you mentioned earlier, this is, you know, some work and some research that, you know, there's not a lot of information out there about it. So, I thank you for taking that time and doing this research on this topic. Hopefully, you know, others will become interested in this and explore their own family histories and maybe, you know, also look at this connection between Italian Americans and African Americans, 20th century going even into the 21st century. And so I think, yeah, let's get into, you know, and you've already gotten into it, you know, very well, but maybe some key points or some key findings that you had in the book that you want to share with the audience. And we definitely want you to go out and buy it, everyone. I mean, this is real stuff, you know, really good stuff. And you can't find this everywhere. So definitely, you know, go out and get Sam's book. But maybe, yeah, tell us some of your key points and ideals, and, you know, and maybe get into a little bit more of how you conducted the research. You know, which specific kind of things. I know you talked about it a little bit, and, you know, but, you know, whether your individuals that you talk to, or was it mainly just, you know, just kind of academic research?
Well, it was for the most part academic research, but of course, when you spill into popular culture, you have to reach out to other kind of sources. You know?
Sure.
And among the very useful sources was the archive, some archival material that I found. At the University of Rochester, they have the archives of Jerry Mangione, was this very important Italian-American intellectual and writer and novelist, who in the 1930s was one of the people who engineered, was a big part of the work, the project administration, Federal Writers Project.
WPA, right.
The WPA. And in 1943, he published this book called Mount Allegro, which is the topic of the second chapter. And in his archive, there's a lot of references to people that he worked with, African-American intellectuals that he worked with during the WPA, such as Sterling Brown and Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison. So I found some reference in there that brought me back to the beginning of the book, especially Booker T. Washington, who is the subject of the first chapter, along with an Italian movie called Nuovo Mondo, which in America was actually presented with a different title called Golden Door, in reference to the Statue of Liberty. So Washington, which is this completely fascinating figure to me.
Absolutely.
You know, right towards the end of his life, just a couple of years before he dies, he takes this tour, this trip to Europe, and he writes this very big book called The Man Farther Down, in which he explores how the laboring classes of Europe live and are treated and their conditions. Called A Study of Observation of the Laboring Classes of Europe. And a good chunk of the book, it's like a 500 pages book, who's not very well studied, you know, and probably not very well known either by people who do this kind of work. But a good chunk of the book is dedicated to Italy and southern Italy. And what is interesting about it is that clearly he was very well prepared when he went over. Before years passed, when he did his, you know, up from slavery, he had a pretty hard stance on immigration. Like he was an anti-immigrant political position that he had.
Sure.
Because obviously he was afraid that, mm-hmm. you know, the immigrants would take away, you know, jobs and from African Americans, right. especially in the South. And so he takes this trip to Europe, and he basically discovers completely new people, so to speak. And one of them, one of these people are these Southern Italians, and especially the women in Southern Italy. What attracts Washington to the Southern Italian women is the fact that, you know, he makes this comparison between the condition in which they live in Southern Italy, in the labor condition, also general life condition, that reminds him of slavery.
Okay.
You know, he's very cautious, as you know, talking about slavery. He's very uncomfortable in the sense that, I mean, his lifelong project is to get away from it, essentially, and integrate African-Americans into the fabric of the country. I mean, the way he envisioned this is a whole different ballgame. But, you know, it's somebody who is a former slave, you know, and is trying to have a modern project for his people. And he's not, you know, he's trying to detach himself from the slave experience. But when he gets there to Italy and he sees these people and the poverty in which they live and the conditions in which they live, you know, he makes this comparison time and again between slaves in the pre-Civil War South and Southern Italian women. And it goes on and on about, you know, how coming to the U.S. is a sort of like, for this immigrant and for this woman, is a sort of like emancipation. The problem with the book, it is, you know, is an entirely patriarchal view of women. And very instrumental, I would say, to a vision of modernity that is based on a capitalist economy, and even way of life, essentially, right? So, sort of like distorts, in a way, the way that this woman, he only talks about the negative side of it.
Okay, you know,
he basically says, you know, when they come to America, they're born again. And that it, you know, the past no longer counts, and so on and so forth. Right? So he makes this immigrant passage as a sort of like positive, entirely positive experience that rejuvenates. You know, it's a classic story of, you know, of immigration, if you want. But if you look into the story, it's much more complex than that, and especially for women.
Many stories are much more
complex. Yeah, many stories are.
Right, than what people think on initial inspection.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's why I juxtaposed Washington Book to this Italian movie about Sicilian immigrants,
the Golden Door.
Sicilian immigrants. Yeah, the Golden Door, Novo Mondo, is in Italian, which you can clearly see that the passage, you know, through Ellis Island was anything but, you know, a joyride, so to speak, and especially for women. At the same time, what the movie does, what I do at least, by juxtaposing the movie and the book, is to make sure, I mean, to make sure to see, to point out how, you know, these women were a lot more complex than the way Washington depicts them.
Okay, right,
And at the same time, that there is some sort of like non-formal intellectual way of being of them. And at the same time, ways of relating to the universe, the physical universe around them, that complicates the story of modernity's, you know, and of immigration as a story of modernity that is entirely a story of emancipation. And I guess that what I'm trying to say, the key point about this is, you know, the story of, like, we come to America to have a better life.
Right.
Yeah, that's the mainstream story. All true. The point is that what needs to be emphasized is that immigration happens by negation.
Mm.
Now, intellectual immigration is a whole different story. But what we know as immigration, what we think of as an immigration, is people who leave their land of origin, not because they want, but because they have to.
Wow, right, right.
Whether because of political conditions, for the most part because of economic conditions.
Sure.
These days you see because of war, right, in the Middle East.
Right, in today's world, right.
In today's world. So the key point here is again that, yes, people may come to look for a better life, but the point is that they leave because they have to, not because they want to. Most of that, right?
And
what they bring with them is an entire way of viewing the world and seeing the world.
You know? Right.
And this is what, at the same time, fascinates and, you know, repels Booker T. Washington. But there's something that he does that is very important to the book, that he detaches, symbolically, obviously, he detaches southern Italy, where immigrants come from Europe. This is clear to him.
Mm-hmm.
He does not associate them, you know, with, he calls, you know, southern Italy and Sicily a bridge to Africa. So he creates this area, this cultural area, this Afro-Mediterranean area, that then becomes, for me, sort of like the perimeter of the research, you know, and say, okay, you know, how come this guy is so invested into this Italian women and men who come to America and detailing their life of poverty in Italy and detaching symbolically from Europe.
Okay.
You know, this is a guy who knows what he's doing, obviously.
Right. Trying to make those connections between the Africans in America. Right. And those southern
Italians.
And he
does. Yeah, of course he has. You know, he keeps saying they are in worse condition than African Americans are. You know, which is a problematic statement to make, but obviously it's trying to advance African Americans, put them ahead of the immigrants. But what it's important to me is not is pretty much the connection that he makes between the two people, and especially between African American former slaves and Italian women from the South.
Right.
So the book develops from that, from the point of the party.
And the book is In the Name of the Mother, Italian Americans, African Americans, and Modernity, from Booker T. Washington to Bruce Springsteen. And we're here with the author Samuel F.S. Pardini, and the book is published by Dartmouth College Press, and we're here on the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network. And, you know, the more I hear you talk, Sam, about your book, I keep looking back at this cover of this young man. It just it just draws my eyes to it. And, you know, hearing you talk about the connections between Italian Americans and African Americans, this young man looks like he could be really a part of either community. You know,
and that's why I picked it. To be honest with you.
Yeah, please tell us more.
Look, there's no information, official information about the photo, who took it, you know. It could be Lewis Hine, or it could be one of those early 20th century folks who went around northeastern cities. This is a photo of an Italian student in 1906.
Right.
That's all the information that is available. And there's no name, the name of the kid, you know, but it, as you know, obviously the listeners can now see, although if they go obviously on the web, they can.
Yeah, you can
but
see
it's
it.
This kid who has, you know, typical Italian kid of the day, southern Italian kid of those days, I guess, with, you know, his books or case under his arm, you know, this hat and the white shirt and the black tie, and he has this face that clearly denotes, you know, well, they, you know, in those days it's a, you know, dark complexion,
right?
Which is what, you know, pretty much that's the way they were categorized, if you want, in Ellis Island, you know, white people of dark complexion,
right?
You know, the Italian American, and that's what makes it interesting, because, like you said, this kid is more like a mulatto person, interracial person, you know. And so where does it belong, you know, and what does sort of like symbolize? I mean, I don't, this is just the cover of the book, it's not that I talk about the photo in the book,
but he was representative, sort of like, from your
is a representative, sort of like an invitation, you know, to dig into where does this, you know, invisible blackness come from.
Right, your concept, right.
You know, the concept, which brings me back to Mangione and his book Mount Allegro, because, which is the subject of chapter two, because he goes about the life of these immigrants, people, this Italian in a Rochester neighborhood. And what he does for the most part is clearly show the diversity of the Italian, the racial diversity of the Italian, and how the ways of life are completely incompatible with the political economy of capitalism and industrial capitalism of the day. But what he really, what really interests me is that, and I go over this, but towards the end of the book is all about his family and his relatives, this sort of like two blocks in the street in Rochester where they live and how they live and what they do and what they don't do. And so on and so forth. But towards the end of the book, he talks about, you know, this party the family had.
Right.
And the kids that listen to jazz. Right? There's no mention of the only America that you see throughout the in the book is either the Italian America of his family or the white America that is, you know, a force of discrimination for that. Okay? In school, in the factory where they work, there's few passages in which it's clear that, you know, white America is doesn't welcome these Italian immigrants. Right? But there's no hint whatsoever of any African American presence or black presence in the book until you get to this moment in the book in which he talks about the kids listening to jazz.
Oh, right, right.
And of course, I mean, at that point in time, we're talking, you know, mid-20s, there's a lot of Italian Americans who play jazz and do jazz. Right? But nonetheless, this is a music that is associated, rightly so, with African American culture.
With African American culture, right?
It's not an Italian invention, obviously. Right? And even more so, in the very at the very end of the book, he takes a trip to Sicily, to his relative's hometown, and he discovers that there's a religious festa in town that celebrates this black saint, which, by the way, they still have in the town there. And you can Google, you can go on YouTube and see the procession, and you see all these people carry on the statue of this saint, black saint, whose the mythic story is that he came originally from Ethiopia, and it was a doctor that cured kids especially and sick people, and that's why he became, he was sanctified. And so, and he juxtaposed the saint, the black saint, to Mussolini, and the problem of fascism. So he uses, you know, in the end, he makes a bridge to blackness. After throughout the book talking about the racial diversity of the time, right? And he's sort of like saying, look, the blackness actually is part of the Italian identity, certainly for people who come from the South.
Right.
And not only, I mean, there's in Italy, there's, and in other parts of Europe too, but especially in Italy, in Southern Italy, and Central Italy, there's plenty of the so-called Black Madonnas.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So representation of the Virgin as a black person.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So in a way, Mangione, what he does is retraces this black roots of his Italian identity that he's looking for when he goes to Sicily. And on top of it, he connects the music that he hears at the festa for the procession, I think, with what he calls the Harlem Nights. When he was in New York, and after college, he went to work in the publishing industry in New York City, and, you know, apparently he used to go out to this, you know, Harlem class when he first heard many, you know, jazz musicians, of course. And so he makes this connection between his Italian-American identity that he's trying to describe or at least map, and the black roots in his very hometown. And then he goes back to the U.S. and he associated with the music that he hears there.
Wow. Yeah.
So the overlapping increases in the book. And at that point, that's where you get to the central part of the book, which is chapter 3.
Right.
And you have this African-American literati from Johnson all the way to Baldwin. Mm-hmm. So they cover the entire spectrum of the development of African-American literature in the 20th century until civil rights.
James Weldon Johnson up to James Baldwin.
Yes. And they all have a significant Italian-American presence in one of their books. And there's a huge investment in it, you know, and it's both literary and historical, I would say. And one of the key, if not the key book, the key text, and its chapter is Richard Bruce Nugent, Gentleman Jigger, which is an incredibly fascinating book. He was, you know, one of the Harlem Renaissance guys.
Right.
But he didn't get to this novel. He didn't get to publish this novel in his lifetime. And if I'm correct, it was published after he was, after he passed.
Okay.
But regardless, this is a novel essentially about this African-American character who enters, literally, the Italian-American world of New York City first and Chicago later. And not just the Italian-American world, but the underworld. Mm. He gets involved with gangsters, hoodlums and gangsters. Apparently, you know, he has this character called Orini in the Chicago part, which is pretty much the second section of the novel, who apparently he modeled after Lucky Luciano.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that somehow he had met Luciano in his life, and so that seems to be the real figure that he modeled this gangster after.
Wow.
And what it does is it doesn't just, you know, crosses the ethnic and racial lines,
right,
and class lines as well, but he makes this gangster homosexual, and not just this gangster, he makes Lucky Luciano homosexual, essentially. Right? He was an homosexual man himself, very attracted to Italian culture and aesthetics. Okay? Makes a very compelling case about aesthetics in the book.
Sounds like a movie. It could be coming out.
It's interesting because it's not a plot. Obviously, it's not a plot-driven book at all. But it would be, I think, a very good movie.
I think
actually.
It would.
That somebody should make.
It might need to be you and me, Sam. We might need to write that.
I'm not sure how you get to find the resources to do that.
we could write the script for that.
We wouldn't have fascinating.
To, we could leave the Academy forever and become Hollywood producers.
Yeah.
But yeah,
that's where the notion of invisible blacksmith really takes,
right?
You know,
with that story.
Down roots, if you want, because he really makes the case for Italian. When he says Italian, he means Italian Americans, obviously, of not being white people. Mm-hmm. Okay? But he does not focus solely on, or hardly on the color. Skin color. Okay? It makes a whole argument about, you know, anti-social socialization and the way, you know, these people live and who they are and how they present themselves, right? And it's obviously, it's not a post-racial reading or argument that I'm making there, right? Starting with Gentleman Jigger, and then the other books that I talk about that belong to the African American literary canon. Is what I'm saying is this investment of these African American men of letters into Italian Americans is a way for them to get away from what Alan Locke called the formulaic representation that white America has of black Americans. They use them. Them being Italian Americans, and especially Italian American men, to as a sort of like a surrogate for African American, and show a, you know, a representation of the male, of the African American man, that is otherwise unavailable because all they can see, or they can't see, white people is a black male.
And you meant by Locke, you mean Alan?
Yes.
Locke? Right.
Alan Locke. Okay. Right.
Just for clarity, I don't think we're talking about John Locke.
No. Alan Locke says, you know, they have this formulate idea of, you know, of African American white people that basically doesn't see us as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do, you know, and Gentleman Jigger is important because, you know, he turns gangsters, which supposedly are, you know, the epitome of, you know, male sexuality and machismo, if you want. I mean, of
men, for some know, people of Italians.
Yeah, of course, of Italians. Oh, absolutely. That's, you know, that's the next chapter.
Yeah, we're getting a little too early. Yeah. Right? Keep going.
But, you know, and saying he makes this, you know, epitome of masculinity, actually, homosexuals, which many of them were, or at least they were bisexual.
Right.
You know, it's
it was just more hidden.
It's
than
a sort of like well kept secret,
right?
You know, that the mob, and I think I can't remember the name, and I apologize for the fellow who wrote the introduction to the book, but you know, it's no secret that actually mobster. We're happy to promote homosexual relations on people who work for them because they consider women a danger to the business, so to speak. Right. So, Gentleman Jigger is really the moment in the chapter that opens up all sorts of like possibilities. They return later on with other writer, and especially Baldwin at the end of the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And, you know, and there is this trade union, if you want, that is provided by the figure of the gangster, both and Gentleman Jigger, and then Knock on Any Door, which is a bestseller from the...
from that time.
From the time, from the 40s and 50s, you know, who was turned into absolutely unwatchable movie. by Nicholas Ray with Humphrey Bogart. It's really bad. But
the views of Samuel Pardini are not necessarily the views of
well,
Network on that movie.
I think that most people actually agree that that's not exactly Ray's best achievement, you know, because it's just a bad movie. Especially if you read the novel.
Right, you know, in comparison. It didn't live up to the standards.
It's really, you know,
but I can tell my audience, that may have been a bad movie from a good book, but I can tell my audience that this is a good book that you wrote here, Sam Pardini.
Thank you.
And the book is In the Name of the Mother, Italian Americans, African Americans, and Modernity from Booker T. Washington to Bruce Springsteen. And I'm here with the author, Samuel F.S. Pardini. He's an associate professor at Elon University, and the book is published by Dartmouth College Press, our friends at Dartmouth College Press. So thank you so much for publishing this great work by Sam Pardini. I wanted to make sure that we got that title in, because all this great stuff you're talking about in this scholarship, Sam, we want to make sure they know where they can get that book.
And go on Amazon, or you can go on University Press in New England website.
Absolutely. And pick that book up.
Books and pick it up.
And I wanted to mention this. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sam.
It's also available on ebook as an ebook.
Okay. Right.
So electronic version, which also has the advantage of having all the visual material in color pictures.
Included,
you know,
as well. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, the picture that there's some 10 images in the book, and a few of them, I mean, they're all in black and white because obviously cost of production for color pictures are prohibitive at this, you know, for university presses, or most of them. But the electronic version has the original, if you want, so they're color.
Yeah, so the benefit of ebooks. One of the many benefits of ebooks for those who prefer ebooks. And I wanted to mention, too, before I forget, Sam, because you never know who's listening on the New Books Network. But, you know, the picture of the young man from, I think you said, 1906, early 20th century. If someone recognizes that picture,
that would be awesome.
Or recognizes that young man, please get in contact with Sam and at Elon, Sam Pardini at Elon, and let him know, because I'm sure, like you, Sam, you would love to know some more background or history.
That would be really, you know, that's a dream.
Right.
If I had a wish, is that I could find who this kid and the photo is. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you know, I mean, I tried to find information, but
it's challenging for that time period.
Yeah. Right. But it really is a great photo,
and it would
be wonderful to find out who the kid actually is.
So if you're listening and, you know, you see the cover of the book on the New Books Network website or on Sam's page or on the Dartmouth Press page, and you recognize this man, it could be your grandfather, your great-grandfather, your great-uncle, or whatever the case may be. You know, if you're of Italian heritage, you know, this is a picture from New York, 1906. Please get in contact with Samuel Pardini at Elon University. And in general, I'm sure, Sam, you would be loved to hear from people if they want to tell their own stories about Italian-Americans and African-Americans as well. Would you be welcome and open to those contacts as well?
Oh, absolutely. That would be magnificent. You know, I would love to hear stories, or, you know, from both sides, possibly.
Yeah.
And or, you know, just, you know, response to the book. You know, I mean, the second part of the book deals more with popular culture, so it's got it would interest more of a general audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's got the Godfather movies in there. It's got rock music, I mean, Sinatra, and Franklin and Sammy Davis, and Springsteen, and Clarence Clemons, so, you know, sort of like targets more of like general audience, if you want. But that would be great to hear from folks.
But I would argue too, Sam, even your first couple of chapters there, you know, are going to interest general audience as well, because, I mean, just thinking about family connections, their family histories, and they may even think back to music that they heard growing up as children, you know, in their Italian-American home or, you know, in their African-American home, you know, the connections and just the knowledge and knowing about the, you know, the connections in the African-American community. You know, we talked a little offline about Spike Lee and his work.
Yes.
And, you know, as a filmmaker, you know, a person from Brooklyn, New York, and his connections with the Italian-American community. Two of my favorite movies are both by Spike Lee. One is Do the Right Thing. which is about, civil and, and racial unrest. But then also Miracle at St. Anna.
I'm actually...
it's one of my favorites.
I have a personal connection to it. Now that you mention it, and, in the sense that St. Anna is just very little, more of a, here you would say a village, which is actually some 10 miles from my hometown.
Wow, okay.
And I think the only survivor of the massacre, happened to live across from me. Mm-hmm. He was the vice principal of the middle school that I attended.
Okay.
And his daughter was actually my classmate.
Wow.
And he never... It's very difficult
for I can imagine.
Person. He never talked to us. He never mentioned anything. He didn't make... he lost his family and basically the entire village. But the other connection that I have, that I didn't tell you offline, but that I have, which I mentioned a little bit in the acknowledgement, is that this little town that I had was during the war, was where the Buffalo Soldier, the American Army and the Buffalo Soldier were stationed.
Right.
So my father was forced to leave town when the Nazis came. And when the Americans came and liberated him, for him, the Americans were the African Americans. Because it was the Buffalo Soldier that liberated my dad and his family. And he actually lived next door to them, because when the army arrived and they settled in the town, obviously it was a segregated army. So there was one side of the street, the white part of the American army was there. And on the other side, which was my dad's home house, was the Buffalo Soldier were stationed. So he told me a story about, these African-American soldiers that, he used to steal chocolate from in their jeeps, and that's how he got actually interested in jazz music.
Right.
To begin with, and my dad, when he was older, actually had a chance to come to the United States during his military service with the Navy, and he got in, New York at a time when the great jazz musicians were performing in New York and then Virginia. So there's a connection. I have another connection.
Right.
Because
a great
one
personal
of my,
connection for you. Absolutely.
Yeah, a distant relative of mine is actually, his mom is the product of, his mom fell in love with one of Buffalo soldiers and they had this kid together, So, in many ways, African American has been a part of my life since I was a kid. And part of my family's history in some fashion.
Right. Well, you did a great service, Sam, with your book, In the Name of the Mother, Italian Americans, African Americans, and Modernity, from Booker T. Washington to Bruce Springsteen. And that's a great personal story. And, the movie that we're talking about, everyone, if you're not familiar with the Spike Lee movie, is maybe 10 or so years old, maybe now. And it's called Miracle at St. Anna, and it's based on a historical fiction novel about something that really happened during World War II. And it was, just like Sam just said, it was some Buffalo soldiers, some black soldiers from a segregated unit that were involved in helping to liberate this Italian town. I mean, it's a great movie. The novel, even more so. But I definitely would recommend it. The author of the novel escapes me, but the novel, the name is the same as the movie, Miracle at St. Anna. And as you heard Sam just say here, he's got a personal connection, with the town, as well as his father, with some of the Buffalo soldiers that helped to liberate Italy from the Nazis during World War II. Wow. That's a great story, Sam. And, and as I told you offline, yours is a great American story, coming from Italy to the United States and finding success here. marrying here and, you know, and becoming a scholar. So, you know, kudos to you for your great success story. You know, you had to work hard for what you have. That's why I want to make sure everyone knows your academic background. You didn't just roll off the turnip truck and start writing this book.
A lot of people work hard, obviously.
Absolutely. That's what we used to say growing up. You know, roll off the turnip truck. You didn't just roll off the turnip truck and write this book. So, we're here on the New Books Network, the African American Studies channel with Samuel Pardini. He's an associate professor at Elon University, and we're talking about his book about the connections between Italian-Americans and African-Americans, mainly in the 20th century. In the Name of the Mother, Italian-Americans, African-Americans, and Modernity, from Booker T. Washington to Bruce Springsteen. And as you mentioned, Sam, towards the end of the book, you get into, you know, the whole Italian gangster thing and the mob and a lot more into the, you know, popular culture, you know, connections. One of my favorite movies from the 1970s has a James Brown soundtrack, is Black Caesar.
Yeah.
You know, which is about the, you know, Italian...
exploitation.
Yeah. The black version of an Italian gangster. And there's been many since then. You know, New Jack City, which was a movie that came out when I was early college, high school age, you know, and so on and so forth. You have many... particularly 10 or 15 years ago, you had many of the hip-hop artists that named themselves after Italian mafioso, because, you know, that was considered to be, impressive, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, please tell us a little more. Yeah,
yeah, in chapter, well, it's interesting what you say, although I don't get into a hip-hop, the Italianization of hip-hop, if you want, symbolically sure. speaking, and... or the mafiaization of the pop. But, you know, it's true. I mean, essentially, all those rappers and hip-hoppers that uses gangster reference,
mm-hmm.
they do it on the basis of two movies. One is Scarface,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is The Godfather.
Well, they love Scarface, absolutely.
Yeah, although I believe that, you know, I mean, I'm not a scholar of a hip hopper,
mm-hmm.
So my feeling is that they when they think of Scarface, they think of the early '80s, I think.
Right, the Cuban American version,
the Cuban with Al Pacino in there.
Who was that Cuban?
Probably, and they probably don't know about the original Scarface mm-hmm. from the 1932 with the pigs, actually. An Italian-American gangster, supposedly Al Capone, obviously, that played by Paul Mooney,
mm-hmm.
who was not Italian. and the other one is obviously The Godfather.
Of course,
which is half of the chapter 4 is actually about The Godfather. Both the first and the second movies and the novel. And I used The Godfather and then two novels, Franklin's Ricci, The Music of the Inferno,
mm-hmm.
and Don DeLillo, Masterpiece Underworld, pretty much map a trajectory of the gangster and Italian-American masculinity from an outsider, from, you know, the other,
mm-hmm.
another figure, to white power broker.
Mm.
And yet, I go back to this notion of the invisible blackness that is especially useful in to talk about the gangster. Because
mm-hmm.
one of the things that is left out from the first Godfather movie and somehow recuperated in the second one,
mm-hmm.
which I talk extensively about in the book, is all these references that Mario Puzo, the author of the novel,
right.
makes to The Godfather and his family, you know, as being, you know, people of dark complexion.
Mm-hmm.
Complexion. He talks about the original village where he comes from, Corleone, as a Moorish village,
mm-hmm.
which is a way of saying it's an African village, essentially,
right.
where,
that's,
you know,
where the Moors were in North Africa.
The Moors established themselves. So he talks about his wife, Mama Corleone, with his olive skin. I mean, all these racial underlined in the book, mm-hmm. in the novel. It doesn't come out. It's completely erased in the first movie. Okay, but it's something that seemed the way I read the Godfather trope, and especially the second one,
mm-hmm.
Using as a sort of like background the first movie and the novel, is how this, again, the invisible black hunts Michael, Corleone, as he develops and as he becomes, you know, the Don mm-hmm. of the family, right? And so he's obtained to, in some fashion, pass as white and and more than that, like achieve whiteness, you know, and this, and, you know, and this conflict between, you know, the values that in some fashion the history of the family represent.
Okay?
I mean, there's a whole story of how his father, you know, I was talking before about, you know, immigration happening by negation.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that it makes clear in the second movie, which is not very much talked about it, mm-hmm. is that the godfather has to flee Sicily.
It's
not
somebody
who comes here looking for a better life.
Mm-hmm.
He's living because he needs to save his life. Right? Because the soldiers of the mafia don't. are trying to kill him, right? So, and then when he gets to New York in Little Italy, they experience the same story, right? Mm-hmm. It's this mafia don that, you know, is responsible for his losing his job, you know, at the grocery store where he works. So this sort of like background is in the mind of Michael as he develops, you know, and his plan to expand the family and
mm-hmm.
sort of like turn into this, you know, trying to build this corporate empire, you know, that goes transnational when he tries to move to Cuba, you know, with the other fellow mobster. I mean, create a sort of like transnational business. And then, now, there's the conflict between what he wants to achieve mm-hmm. as a businessman and what he's unable to do as a man.
Mm. Certainly important things to consider there. I mean, and you did a great job, Sam, and you know, in that chapter and your others, and making those connections. I mean, you really went deep, you know, into the Puzo, the Mario Puzo, and, you know, book, the novel, as well as here with the movie. And, you know, and I just recall, you know, I was very young when the Godfather movies came out, but I can just recall, you know, the whole thing, it was kind of controversial at the time, and even later about, you know, selling the drugs to the blacks and,
yes.
you know, and some, you know, some of those kind of things. And I think in some ways that helped kind of, you know, make some tensions there, you know, and make some separation between the Italians and the Africans. You know, we're not as similar, you know, that's them, and it's okay to treat them that way. You know,
yes.
You know, and you know, and we're different. And you saw that a little bit too. And, you know, we talked about some of the Spike Lee movies. You know, like the Jungle Fever, and, you know, and Do the Right Thing. It's like, you know, even though we may historically have some connections, we don't want to be associated with those folk. We're different.
Yeah, so I mean, that's the gangster is a perfect example how you mm-hmm. try to distance yourself from that past or that
right.
association. That, you know, is the origin of this gangster trope, you know. And the way I read Michael Corleone's trajectory is exactly that. And mm-hmm. even more so, it's developed later in the novel that I talk about Franklin Tricchia and Don DeLillo in The Musical Inferno and mm-hmm. Underworld Spatula, you know. It's exactly that, you know.
It's like there's an anger or a, you know, just aggressiveness to want to not be associated to, you know, with the darker skinned people, or, you know, people who may be considered lower than or less than within this American society and culture.
Yeah, because that's what, you know, that's how respectability is awarded, right?
Right.
In this country for the most part.
Absolutely. And we're here with the author of In the Name of the Mother, Italian Americans, African Americans, and Modernity, from Booker T. Washington to Bruce Springsteen. The author, Samuel F.S. Pardini. He's an associate professor at Elon University. So for all our North Carolina folks, if you're Elon fighting Phoenix, Sam is one of you, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so you can go by and check him out and see him. And In the Name of the Mother, you know, and as we talked about, Sam, there's a great connection between the mother in the African-American community and in the Italian-American community, as well as the religious, you know, connection with that as well.
Yeah, and that is actually the focus of the chapter 5,
mm-hmm.
Which is the longest chapter in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Both in terms of number of pages, but also in terms of the chronological span that he covers, because
Absolutely.
He focuses in on all these novels from the early, from the mid-30s to mm-hmm. almost the present, one mm-hmm. of them at least, and some song, too, by Springsteen. And the theme that holds the whole chapter together is this trope, this female trope called, this woman called Maria.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a unique presence in American literature, because that I know of, and believe me, I did a lot of research and read up a lot of books, right, to make sure I was getting it right.
Yes, you're a true scholar.
It's this woman called Maria, and of course there's the Catholic background there.
Sure.
It's a unique presence. There's no other, you know, range of American literature, whether it is African American, Asian American, or just, you know, what you call probably Anglo American literature,
mm-hmm.
it has this a recurring female figure that carries the same name,
mm-hmm.
you know, for pretty much the whole century. Right. So I was interested in seeing what are the connection between the novels that employs this trope,
mm-hmm.
this female trope, you know, from the early 30s, like I said, when pretty much the Italian American literary tradition in the novel form mm-hmm. begins, to the present, and you know, in terms of form, I deviate a little bit, because as a bridge between post-World War II and the 70s, you know, I used popular songs, especially, not especially solely, mm-hmm. Bruce Springsteen songs, who has the same character called Maria or Mary,
mm-hmm.
depends. All over is you know, songbook, what he
right.
calls songbook. So it provides a very useful link between the literature of the 30s and the 40s, and then get into the 70s and the 80s. You know. And to make a long story short, essentially what this woman represents is a sort of like alternative modernity for Italian Americans. So she's a representative, if you want, of the immigrant struggles. And she's the one that breaks the color line more than anybody else,
mm-hmm.
or the ethnic line for that matter, not just, you know, in multiple ways,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's a fascinating connection, because it really, you know, crosses times and environments, if you want. I'm talking about like literary environments, context,
of course,
you know, and writers, both men and women, adopt this figure. You
mm-hmm.
know, some poets too do that. You know, it's really, you know, I would call it like a universal figure that helps shape Italian American novelistic tradition.
Mm.
And, you know, I would guess that I don't think it's going to disappear.
No, I don't think so either.
No. And obviously, like I said before, there is the Catholic background in it. You know, whether it is with John Fante's novel that I talk about, Wait Until Spring, Bandini,
mm-hmm.
or the this other novel by a man called Michael DeCapito, who unfortunately, he wrote this fantastic novel called Maria that I talk about in the book, extensively. Unfortunately, he died very young when he was making him, you know, was developing as a writer. He managed to write two more novels, but I think he died in a car accident at a relatively young age. So, you know, it's unfortunately that the book didn't resonate more than I think it deserved. It's out of print, and it would be great if somebody out there listening that is able to, you know, embark on a project to
bring it back,
because I really think that is a fantastic novel, and it has a lot.
Well, say the name again and the author. Maybe someone will listening will be able to do that.
The author is Michael DeCapite,
DeCapite,
and the novel is called Maria, just like the
just
name.
Maria
of the,
only, right? Okay.
Yeah, the female figure, which is at the end, at the center of the novel, you know.
You never know, Sam.
Well,
you never know who's listening. They might be able to grant your wish.
Yeah, I use it sometimes in the classroom, and I have very good response from the students.
Good.
So I think it is a book that, you know, speaks to students to these days.
That's
and
good.
It would deserve a second chance, for sure. So, this character is present throughout the Italian American literary tradition, like I said, and also in the popular culture, especially the music, popular culture that I get to in the last chapter.
Oh, right.
Chapter 6 is where the focus is on the relationship between Italian Americans and African Americans on the stage.
Stage and subversion. Right.
Yeah, and I use two bipartisanship. Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr.
Oh yes, the famous
and then the famous duo, you know, and then Springsteen and Clarence Clemens,
right?
Yeah, and the interesting to me, at least, the interesting thing about this is how come of all the popular culture, and especially popular music, in the 20th century, is the kingdom of ethnic and racial people, for the most part, right? I mean, especially popular culture, as well as working class whites from the South. Elvis is a white man, he's working class. Johnny Cash, the same. Up north, you have all these ethnic white folks involved in creating you know, what we know as modern popular culture. But the main the stage is usually entirely white. Even when you have multi-ethnic bands or feet.
The people you see in the forefront, right?
Yes. But you have this connection, it returns again, and two main figures of American popular culture, which are Frank Sinatra and Bruce Springsteen. Whether you like the music or not is a different story, obviously.
But you know who they are.
But these are essential makers of American popular culture, and probably a little more, certainly for Sinatra, in Sinatra's case. And these are two men who shared, you know, their stage, you know, for, you know, almost their entire life. With two decades, for sure, with two African-American men, right? And you don't have this with other very important white ethnic.
Not very often.
Like Bob Dylan, who's Jewish, obviously, mm-hmm. as we know, never had a central, a black figure on stage that is central to his career as much as Davis Jr. or Clarence Clemons are to mm-hmm. Bob Sinatra.
And Springsteen,
right? And they acknowledge, both Sinatra and Springsteen, what they do is they acknowledge the importance how these men that they share the stage with,
mm-hmm.
you know, they are representative of a tradition and a story and a history that is central to them.
Wow.
Both as artists, you know, as makers of music, and, you know, as who they are, as mm-hmm. person.
Yes.
And in Sinatra is obviously more obvious for chronological reasons,
mm-hmm.
right? He's the son of, you know, recent immigrants, essentially. I mean, he was born, I think, in 1917, so he's really, you know, at the center of that immigrant process
mm-hmm. right.
of the early 20th century, right? When Italians are not integrated or assimilated yet
mm-hmm. not the way
into
that they
the
were
social later. Fabric of the country as they are by the time that Springsteen comes around
right.
and makes himself, yeah, right? But yet, if you... I do the research and see how this art is developed.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the case of Springsteen, there's a clear connection between his, which is not very talked about it.
No.
Right? And he doesn't really talk about it too much as well himself.
Mm-hmm.
Although recently he published his autobiography,
mm-hmm.
and he has an entire chapter about the Italian, his Italian family on the mother's side.
Okay.
And it makes several references to this past. Right? Mm. His grandfather was an immigrant from Naples, mm-hmm. and so was his grandmother. Right? And then he makes this connection between the immigrant story and blackness
mm-hmm.
that translates into sharing the stage with this musician, mm-hmm. African-American musician,
right.
and becoming his lifelong partner, you know, on the stage, who is essential to develop his artistry.
Mm. Right. Wow.
And I used two moments in both artists' careers, in Frank Sinatra and Springsteen careers,
mm-hmm.
on stage, mm-hmm. in which they perform mm-hmm. My argument is that they use their body mm-hmm. essentially, their bodies mm-hmm. and their music mm-hmm. to enact some sort of like subversive racial
mm-hmm.
Representation.
Right. If it's okay for them, then it should be okay for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Springsteen is probably the only person who's been able for decades to have literally thousands and thousands of people, you know, applaud or exploding joy when he introduced a black man, calling him king of the world mm. and master of the universe, which is a particularly, you know, ironic, if you want, side to it.
Mm-hmm.
And he did this, whether it was performing in the South or in the North, the East or the West of the country, you know, and his audience is almost entirely white.
Right.
Right. But he has this central figure on stage who's black, right, that the audience almost, you know, reveres.
Right. They universally respect him.
There is respect. They almost worship, you know. And And there's a lot of, you know, racial stuff happening
during those years.
On this stage. Yeah, on this stage for all those years, you know. And the problem, obviously, is also, I mean, the beauty of it is also the limit of it, you know. Mm. It's easy to do it when you perform on stage. And this is the limitation of popular culture, you know, which is totally entangled as, you know, in the capitalist economy, if you want, the political economy of it, which makes it, you know, both, you know, attractive and difficult to relate to. And because once you get off stage, of course, things get a lot more complex.
But everyone loves music.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You sure do. You sure do.
All right. And so I'm here with the author of In the Name of the Mother, Italian Americans, African Americans, and Modernity, from Booker T. Washington to, as you just heard, Bruce Springsteen. Because we could add Clarence Clemens in there too, maybe in parentheses.
I sure do.
And with Samuel F.S. Pardini, he's a great scholar from Elon University. And his book is published by our friends at Dartmouth College Press. And I really enjoyed talking to you, Sam. I'm hoping we can do it a whole lot more on a range of issues. But I don't want to talk with you. I don't want to keep you all day. You're a professor, and you've got plenty of things to do. But before we go, and thank you so much. You've outlined every chapter in the book for us, and you really explain a lot of the concepts. So I'm hoping that people who are listening really can kind of get into the things you're talking about and want to go out there and purchase this book and learn more about the deep roots and the connections between Italian Americans and African Americans. But before I let you go, can you maybe tell us a little bit more about some of your other research or projects that you have, upcoming, or things that people can find now, or that you want to share with us where they could find some of your research? I know you mentioned some of your earlier books near the beginning of our interview.
Yes. Well, first of all, let me thank you for letting me talk about the book, and I hope that people get a general overview.
My pleasure.
Of what it is,
what
I try to do with it. As far as my present research, as I mentioned to you, I was, I studied with Leslie Fiedler. Mm-hmm. I was his last student, and I got very close to him. So recently, like a year and a half, 2 years ago, his family has given me, his World War II correspondence with his wife, with his first wife. Fiedler volunteered. He was a professor at Montana, and then it was Montana State University. It's University of Montana in Missoula.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a professor there during World War II. And in 1943, he decided to volunteer in the Navy. Mm. And he was a translator from Japanese for the Navy. And in the book that I mentioned before that I did, The Devil Gets His Due, there's one of his last essays, which is his experience at Iwo Jima, where he was in the famous, he talks about the flag raising, the famous flag raising, and the photo of the American soldier raising the flag on Iwo Jima. Anyway, during the 3 years that he was in the Navy, he had a pretty substantial correspondence with his wife, his first wife, Margaret. And his letters, almost all of them, or at least a good chunk of them, to be precise, 367 of them.
Wow.
Yeah. He loved his wife. He loved his wife, and he loved to write.
And he loved to write.
Yeah, and on average, you were talking about 6 pages per letter. So, these 367 letters survived a massive fire that destroyed his home in Buffalo. And so I have no record of his wife's letters to him, but I have all the letters that he wrote to his wife. And the letters are very fascinating. I started transcribing them, so it's a big project. At the moment, I'm almost 70 letters into it. And they cover, like I said, from 1943 to 1945, when his service finished. And he talked about all sorts of stuff, you know, the war, politics, literature, you know, contemporary literature of the time, of course.
Sure.
There's a letter, it's essentially an essay on Milton, you know, the British poet. So,
wow.
Nature, you know, Japanese traditions when he's in Japan. So there's, it's really a fascinating view, or sort of like preview into a, you know, one of those critics that will become essential to the study of post-World War II
and early insight
American literary traditions. So, and you know, at the moment I'm transcribing the letter, it's a lot of work, and but I can see, you know, the project taking, you know, getting a shape.
Oh, yeah.
And
another book.
You, yeah, a book of a selection of these, and probably it will have to be a thematic selection.
Mm, right, that's what I was still thinking when you were describing that, right?
Yeah, because of course there are, you know, parts of the letters are private and personal that with no interest to any audience, and so it makes no sense, obviously. But there's, you know, a ton of stuff that once it is put together thematically, I think it will make for a very interesting book.
I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the project that I'm currently doing, and it's taking, you know, between teaching and this project, it leaves very little time for anything else.
It takes time, and that's something that people need to realize. Yeah. You know, you don't just knock one of these books out in like a month. I mean, it takes years to sometimes decades, depending on what's going on in your life and, you know, what the subject matter is. I mean, you know, you mentioned over 300 letters?
Was it 600? It's 367.
300, right. So that's going to take you some time to
go through those. It's going to take a lot of time. I'm fortunate that the university is supporting me very much, and they're giving me a spring semester off next year.
Good.
So they would obviously give me a lot of time to work on the project exclusively, and hopefully get, you know, not get, I mean, obviously not get it done, but, you know, close to
get a good bit of it. Yeah, pretty far along in the process. And I think, I mean, that sounds great, Sam, and it'll be a great tribute from you to someone who was very influential on your life and your research and your scholarship.
Absolutely.
And so I look forward to, you know, hopefully we can get you back here on New Books Network when you get that done.
So that'd be my pleasure. I would love to do that, absolutely.
To talk with you some more about that. And, you know, and so for people who are interested in that work, you know, that Samuel's working on now, please contact him as well. You know, you may have some things that could be helpful for him, or you may be interested in assisting him with that process. Because, yeah, you're definitely, Sam, becoming a scholar on your mentor there, you know, particularly with this next book, you will be. one of the foremost scholars.
I suppose, right? Yeah, I am. I mean, I know, even more so after this project, which is very unique.
Right, you know? It is. It sounds great. And again, we're here with the author of this particular project, In the Name of the Mother, Italian-Americans, African-Americans, and Modernity, from Booker T. Washington to Bruce Springsteen. The book is published by Dartmouth College Press. The author, Samuel Pardini. He's a researcher, a scholar at Elon University, the Phoenix, back there in Elon, North Carolina. And I'm hoping too, Sam, you know, that at some point you'll find some time to continue your work on the connections between Italian Americans and African Americans, you know, into modern times. I would love your take on some of these Italian influenced hip hop scholars, or some of the Spike Lee films, and so on. Yeah. I would love your take on and some of your personal stories about the miracle at St. Anna. That's just my personal interest.
Well, there's obviously, I mean, by no means the book has any, doesn't touch on everything. Like I said, it couldn't. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I think would be interesting to look into, and I might as well do it myself at one point is, you know, a very interesting area, I think, is sport.
Right. Yes.
Professional sport and even cultural representation of sport that involve Italian Americans and African Americans. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, the Rocky movies come to mind, especially because of the last movie, not Creed.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of like goes back to the original Rocky, if you want.
Right. How you started it, right?
Oh, the spirit of it. And but you know, there's baseball, and you know, Roy Campanella, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's tons of stuff. You know, that one can look into. Spike Lee. But like I said, I think that it requires a different set of conceptual tools than the ones that are used and in the name of the matter, which is why I stopped where I stopped.
Right, right.
And didn't include what I did include there.
Well, that
certainly is, you know, like I said before, one of the goals of the book is hopefully to inspire other scholars to pursue this line of research or similar lines of research.
Absolutely. So,
you know, and try to expand the field. Because I do believe there's a lot of work to be done.
I think so. And you did a great start, Samuel. So thank you for your interest and your research. And, you know, it was interesting to hear your personal connection, you know, to a lot of these things. So I'm looking forward to talking with you, you know, outside of the interview about some of those things. But we're going to have to close here today. We could keep going all day, Sam, talking about these connections. But you've got to go do your scholarship, and I've got to do mine. So So we're gonna end it right here. But thank you again for
thank
your
you.
Time and for writing this book. I think it's going to be of great interest to our audience, and hopefully, you know, this being on a podcast will expose you to some different people maybe, and you know, you'll hear from some of them. And again, if anyone knows the young man who's on the cover of Sam's book, definitely Samuel Pardini, get in contact with him. He would love to know. It's probably one of your relatives. It's someone's relative. We know that, Sam. Someone in the United States right now, this is their great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather. So take a look at the cover. If it looks like you or your family or someone in your family, definitely get in contact with Samuel Pardini at Elon University in North Carolina. He would love to talk with you about the connections between Italian Americans and African Americans as well. So again, you know, thank you, Sam. The book is In the Name of the Mother, Italian Americans, African Americans, and Modernity, from Booker T. Washington to Bruce Springsteen. The author, Samuel F.S. Pardini, the network, the New Books Network, the channel, the African American Studies Channel, and I'm your host, James Stansel. So we're going to see you next time on the network. And please, Sam, if you don't mind, tell my audience goodbye.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me over. I really enjoy it. And good luck with your work. You're providing a great service to
the academic
and in general community interested in the humanities and history.
Absolutely. And the last thing I'm going to say, Sam, is please keep your promise to me. Bojangles, Cajun filet biscuit, or go and get a barbecue sandwich with coleslaw and some hush puppies in my honor. If you do that, then you paid me back for the interview. How about that, Sam?
I won't let you down, I promise.
All right. And on that note, thank you, Dr. Pardini, and we're going to close out, and we'll see everyone next time on the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, James Stansel. Peace and love. Thank you.